I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, a new statewide reparations program is taking effect, but you wouldn't know that by reading the Seattle Times. Plus,
there's only one person in the state of Washington who has the capability.
Jay Inslee apparently forgot his foray into authoritarianism and how Initiative 2066 would keep rents in Washington state from going even higher. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello, and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. July 4th is our nation's birthday, but before then, there's a much more important birthday to celebrate. Mine. It's my birthday today.
Happy birthday.
Is it okay to, like, tell people that? Because it's just, like, asking for people to wish me a happy birthday.
Let's celebrate your...
Birthdays get better by the year.
Absolutely.
I don't get why when we're younger, old people be like, oh, don't celebrate my birthday. I love it. I'm 36 today. I feel
you've already got a $36 super chat.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. The only thing I want from you guys for my birthday is, if you're not a subscriber to Undivided already, to become a subscriber for $5 a month. And to all of you who are already subscribers, you've already given me the best birthday gift I could ask for. And that's the ability to work for myself and tell the truth and have Nicole here with me. Woo! Okay, we got a lot of good stories today on that end. A few things I want to... Actually, all of these are relevant to stories we've discussed on the show before. But remember, we were really the first news outlet, if you call us that, to talk about, honestly, talk about what is a reparations law in the state of Washington. If you recall, earlier this year, we let you know that if you are buying a home in Washington state, whether you knew it or not, starting January 1st, you're paying into a reparations program. And when we did that story, a lot of people were like, what are you talking about? I didn't hear anything about that. It goes back to a bill that was previously passed in the state legislature called the Covenant Homeownership Program. And what they do is you go into the recorder's office when you purchase a home. Let's say you've got to file five documents with the recorder's office. Well, each of them has an added $100 fee that you will have to pay. And that goes into this homeownership program that helps people of color buy a home for the first time. It's a reparations program. So when we covered this, we were just letting people know that they'd started to collect that money at the recorder's office. Well, now they are starting the program to actually allow people of color to use funds from the fund that people have been paying into. So the Seattle Times reported on that development, that now this is fully operational. People who qualify for the program can start getting down payment assistance, et cetera, et cetera. But something struck me about the Seattle Times story. So here's the headline. WA program to help first-time homebuyers with history of discrimination. It calls it, in the reporting, an explicit effort to redress the lasting efforts of discrimination. The Covenant Homeownership Program could help hundreds of people of color become homeowners in Washington, but it may also face legal challenges. The Seattle Times goes on to say, the new assistance is open to Washingtonians who can show either that they lived in the state before April of 1968, when the Fair Housing Act outlawed housing discrimination, or that they are descendant of a parent or grandparent who lived in the state at that time. State guidelines allow homebuyers to qualify if they are Black, Hispanic, Native American, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, or other Pacific Islander, Korean, or Asian Indian. So this is a very lengthy article from the Seattle Times on the Covenant Homeownership Program. There is one word that does not appear in the article at all. What do you think it is? One word in this entire article that is about a reparations program that does not appear one time. It is the word reparations. Nowhere in the Seattle Times reporting on this do they refer to the program as reparations. And people might say, well, Brandi, that's because you're calling it reparations, but they call it a covenant home ownership program. So they're just calling it what it actually is labeled under the law. No, reparations, calling this reparations, remember, it does not come from me. I am not the first one to call this a reparations program. Representative Jamila Taylor, a Democrat who sponsored the bill, called it a reparations program.
You may not have heard, but this is the first in the nation statewide reparations bill.
first in the nation, statewide reparations bill. That's what the Democrat who sponsored the bill called it the day Governor Jay Inslee signed it, a first in the nation of its kind reparations bill. Woo! Applause. But now in this entire Seattle Times article, nowhere in it do they call it reparations. Why do you think that is? That's a choice. That's a choice. And when we talk about media bias, oftentimes it's bias that is the result of omission. It's not necessarily what they choose to cover, but what they choose not to cover or how they choose to cover something. It is an absolute choice by the Seattle Times not to use the word reparations in their reporting. And that's because reparations are not popular. The idea of reparations is not popular even among a lot of progressives and Democrats. So the Seattle Times is making a choice not to call this a reparations program, despite the fact that the bill's Democratic sponsor celebrated the fact that it is a reparations program. Also, when you call it a reparations program, you are going to get more attention toward it. Some of that attention is not going to be positive, and some of that attention is likely going to result in lawsuits. We know there's a lawsuit already in Evanston, Illinois. They have a reparations program there. It's being sued over under the Equal Protections Clause. It's really only a matter of time before someone comes forth and sues over the Covenant Home Ownership Program, aka reparations. But think about that. No mention of the word reparations because the Seattle Times is making a choice that reparations are not popular, reparations have a negative connotation among some people, so we're just going to choose not to use the word at all. And I think that that is deeply dishonest. Call it what it is. Call it what the bill's sponsor called it. Now, there's one other element to this story, totally separate, that I'm just learning about now, and I don't think it's shocking to me, but it just shows that Democrats only care about certain kinds of discrimination. So in the Seattle Times article, as I had mentioned earlier in the reporting, you could qualify for this if you're Black, Hispanic, Native American, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, other Pacific Islander, Korean, or Asian Indian. The Seattle Times article does say this. The assistance focuses on people who may have been subject to racially restrictive covenants, one of the various tools of housing discrimination that were common across America in the early 1900s. The widely used documents and property deeds often barred people of color and Jewish people from certain properties. Then it goes on to say, while various groups, including Jewish people, experienced, quote, well-documented, egregious acts of discrimination, the qualifying groups for this program are the ones still being impacted most deeply or face notable home ownership gaps, wrote the authors of a state commission study whose findings informed the design of the program. So here you have an acknowledgement that there are multiple groups of people in our state and in our nation's history that were explicitly discriminated against when it came to fair housing. There were people of color, I don't think anyone denies that, and then there were Jewish people who, according to the authors of this study that informed this law, suffered well-documented egregious acts of discrimination. But the only ones that they're trying to make whole again through this program are people based on the pigmentation of their skin, not based on religion, which happens to be Jewish at a time when a lot of people on the left and progressives and on the far left are, in my opinion, engaged in severe acts of anti-Semitism. So look, I wouldn't be in favor of this if it did benefit Jewish people either, because I don't think it's constitutional. But here they are admittedly saying, in our history, there are documented egregious acts of housing discrimination against these groups of people, Black people, Asians. We're going to help them, make them whole again in their terms, but we're not going to help Jewish people specifically, despite the fact that they were also discriminated against. Fascinating, isn't it? Fascinating, isn't it? Now, I'll also say that one of the other things that makes that even worse is the Covenant Home Ownership Program does not require that you prove that you or a parent or a grandparent were actually discriminated against, or that you had a grandparent who even attempted to get housing in Washington State pre-1968. Basically, you just have to have a parent or grandparent who was a person of color who lived in the state of Washington pre-1968. There is no burden of proof. That's what I think makes it unconstitutional. Because if you were able to prove that, hey, we were discriminated against in 1996 or in 1966 from buying a house because of the color of our skin, then that's a legitimate claim. The government discriminated against you directly and you can prove harm there. But so this is a program that just basically says, hey, if you had a parent or grandparent, they're a person of color, we're going to require other taxpaying citizens to help you afford your first home. Blatantly unconstitutional. Blatantly unconstitutional, especially now considering you are admittedly excluding Jewish people from that benefit, despite the fact that they were also segregated against. They were also discriminated against, rather, in housing. We don't care about them because, oh, well, they're white. You know, a lot of the Jewish people are white, so no bother there. I guess unless you're a Jewish person of color, then you can get help from the home ownership program based on your skin tone, but not your religion. So someone needs to sue over this. And I think it's someone who is a new home, who's buying, or not even a new home buyer, who's buying a home in Washington State. If you're purchasing a home in Washington State, whether it's your first home or your fifth home, and you have to pay the fee at the recorder's office to go into this program, you have grounds to sue over it. Hell, you don't even have to be white. You don't even have to be white. Everyone's paying into it when they buy a home. So you could be a black person in Washington State purchasing a home. You have to pay into a program that's going to help other black people get their first home, even if they weren't directly discriminated against. You absolutely have a constitutional case. And I'm sure we could help you find an attorney who would take that one up. But it's really interesting that just sort of detail on how Jewish people admittedly acknowledged, you know, they were discriminated against too, but we're not going to help them. We're just going to help people based on the color of their skin. Insane. Seattle Times, reparations. Call it what it is and call it what the Democratic sponsor called it. All right. Governor Jay Inslee apparently forgot his 975 days of playing dictator. Let's remind him, shall we? So there was this Supreme Court ruling that everyone's a flutter about on the left that has to do with presidential immunity. I'm not a constitutional scholar. I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I know the ups and downs of what that means. I don't even know if SCOTUS fully knows because they referred some of it back to lower courts to decide exactly how far a president's immunity can go. It essentially says they're ruling that if a president, you know, does something in the course of his official duties, that he has immunity for that. So can't be held accountable for it. Now, I'll say on my surface reading of it, I don't agree with it. And that might be unpopular, but I do think there's an element of you can do something egregiously bad and criminal as the president of the United States. And so I don't want it to be sort of a get out of jail free card, so to speak. But I also see, and we now see right now, how the criminal justice system is being weaponized in a presidential election year. So this is a messy situation. I don't come down firm on this one way or the other. Again, I'm not the expert on this issue. I am, however, an expert on Governor Jay Inslee's immense moral hypocrisy. So let's stick to that, shall we? So Governor Inslee tweeted out in response to this ruling from SCOTUS, Americans must realize that we can no longer depend on the Supreme Court to preserve and protect the basic functioning of our democracy, one based on the law. The basic functioning of our democracy, coming from a guy who clung to one-man rule, who played dictator for 975 days during the pandemic, and actually had the audacity to say publicly that he was the only one capable of saving lives.
There's only one person in the state of Washington who has the capability to save those lives right now, and it happens to be the governor of the state of Washington.
Yeah, so save it, Jay Inslee, for someone who actually believes that you care about our democracy. It's funny how the people who scream the most and the loudest about, oh, democracy in peril, democracy at risk, they are the first ones to stomp on our democracy when it benefits them. So not only Jay Inslee, 975 days of exerting his emergency powers long after the pandemic was done. Bob Ferguson, the attorney general, who, what did he do the second he felt like he was disadvantaged in the race for governor? He had his campaign write a letter to the Secretary of State. He spoke to the Secretary of State on the phone, asked him to break election law on his behalf, said, bullshit, you can push the envelope. Had it been a Republican candidate, it would still be in the news. It would have tanked that Republican candidate's campaign. But here you have someone in Bob Ferguson, the state's chief law enforcer who wants to be the governor, who cried, Donald Trump is a threat to our democracy for four plus years, and he's the one now spitting on our democracy. So yeah, Jainsley, I don't want to hear anything from you, dictator light, about our democracy and trying to save it. Ridiculous. Okay, one quick follow-up. 12 days ago on this show, we broke an exclusive story about candidate for Attorney General Monica Dhingra. She is a current Washington State Senator. She wants to replace Bob Ferguson, a far-left progressive known for her soft-on-crime policies. And we pointed out that she has been flat-out lying to voters, suggesting she is currently working as a senior deputy prosecuting attorney in King County. And as in, it's not just... I'm not just saying that. Even in the video voter guide for her race for attorney general, here's how she begins the video voter guide.
Hi, I am Monica Dhingra, Deputy Majority Leader of the Washington State Senate, Senior Deputy Prosecuting Attorney with King County, and I'm running to be your next Attorney General.
Yeah, she was a senior deputy prosecutor in King County, but she hasn't worked in that job in a full-time capacity since 2017. 2017, 7 years ago. Yet here she is pushing all these soft on crime policies in Olympia, and she uses her work as a prosecutor, acting like she's in there fighting bad guys in a court of law every day, and she uses that as a crutch to excuse her pro-criminal policies. Well, I can't be pro-criminal. I'm a prosecutor. Except we started getting some tips saying, hey, you should look into her work history because she hasn't been a prosecutor for a long time. So we reached out to the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, asked her for her work history, and they said, indeed. She worked full-time as a prosecutor from 2000 to 2017, and then she came back on two temporary part-time bases to help with some systems that she better understood, and part of that was during the pandemic. So she was there for just a couple months in 2019 and just a couple months in 2021. So after we brought it to the King County Prosecutor's Office attention that, hey, every single one of her social media pages, her campaign site, her state senate site, the video voter guide, her introduction at the debate, she is claiming to work for your office still. She's claiming to be a prosecutor. They followed up, if you recall, and they sent Monica Dhingra an email. It came from the HR department at the prosecutor's office. It came to our attention through a news reporter that you're stating you're a current senior deputy prosecuting attorney rather than a former senior deputy. Will you please correct this in your campaign materials? They provided her, as if she needs to be reminded, what her dates of employment were, and they said, feel free to reach out if you have any questions. So that is where we have an update for you today. So we had put in a public disclosure request with the King County Prosecutor's Office and basically said, hey, if she responds, can we get those emails? Because as of today, as of this moment, none of her campaign material has been updated. None of her social media sites have been updated. So it's been nearly 2 weeks since we revealed that she's been lying about being a current senior deputy prosecuting attorney. And she doesn't care because she hasn't updated any of her stuff. Well, here, come to find out, behind the scenes since our report, Monica Dhingra has been trying to convince the prosecutor's office that she still works there? Is that a good way to explain it? So I want to go through some of these email communications that we have. Honestly, to me, it shows how dishonest she is, but also how unhinged she is. She contradicts herself in these emails. Like she is, I don't know if it's damage control. It's like she's trying to convince herself that she still works somewhere, that she doesn't work anymore. So I had mentioned the email that was sent from Heidi, who is the HR person to Monica Dhingra. So this is in response to that thread. So Monica Dhingra responds to that request saying, hey, can you change this on your campaign material? You don't work here anymore. And Monica says, hi, Lisa Mannion, the current prosecutor, told me I was on a leave of absence and that she considers me a current employee, Monica Dhingra. To which the HR director responds, hi, Monica. I spoke to Lisa and she does not recall having this conversation. Thanks, Heidi. So again, here you have Monica Dhingra trying to convince the HR director that she still works there. So try to let that sink in. So then, Monica Dhingra decides, again, she's still trying to argue this. Like the HR director, no, I spoke to Lisa Mannion. She doesn't recall having that conversation. So Monica Dhingra apparently goes back in time into her emails and forwards the HR department with King County Prosecutor's Office a thread that she says proves that she's just been on a leave of absence this whole time. It doesn't prove that at all, but let's go through it anyway. So she forwards the HR department. The email she sent out October 8th, 2021. You know what the subject line is? Last day. Wow, geez. So this is a, this. She thinks this proves her case. So it's from Manka Dingra. She sent it October 8th, 2021. Subject line, last day. It's sent to Dan Satterberg, the former King County prosecutor, and the incoming prosecutor, Lisa Mannion. Good morning. Today is my last day at the prosecuting attorney's office for 2021. I want to thank you all for the opportunity to return and work in a non-political setting. The experience is always invaluable. Preparing and handling court calendars during COVID really made me appreciate what everyone in the criminal justice system is going through. As always, the staff has wonderful ideas on how to improve our system of justice, and I look forward to incorporating those ideas in 2022. So it sounds like she's saying, you know, incorporate them in her legislative capacity. Like, they have some ideas on how to improve our justice system. So when I go back to Olympia in 2022, I'll incorporate those. So this is an email she's sending saying it's my last day. So Dan Satterberg responds, "Hi, Manka. Always good to welcome you back home after session, and our office is a better place because of you. The offer remains in place for 2022, of course." So basically suggesting, hey, if you want to come back and work for a few months, we'd be happy to have you back in 2022. Lisa Mannion said, "Agreed. Thank you, Manka. It's awesome to have you as a colleague and as a lawmaker." So Manka forwards all of that to the HR department, again, trying to convince them that she was under the impression she's just in a leave of absence. And she says, Manka says in the email, and now this is just 8 days ago. "Good afternoon. I wanted to chat with you both." So she's sending this to the HR department and Lisa Mannion. "Dan Satterberg always informed me that I was on a leave of absence. This email thread led me to believe the same, that I'm on a leave of absence." She goes on to say, "I am very clear that I am not currently working at the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, Manka Dingra." So that obviously makes no sense. So either you're still working there, but on a leave of absence, or you're not currently working there. So in the same email, she's trying to convince the HR department at King County that she's just on a leave of absence, even though they say that she's not. She's also saying, "But I'm also very clear that I'm not currently working at the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office." Nicole, can you re-up her video voter guide for us to see if she is very clear that she's not currently working at the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office?
"Hi, I am Manka Dingra, Deputy Majority Leader of the Washington State Senate, Senior Deputy Prosecuting Attorney with King County, and I'm running to be your next Attorney General."
Huh, doesn't seem very clear to me. I mean, maybe I'm just crazy, but when you tell me you're a prosecutor and you introduce yourself that way, I'm going to assume that you're a prosecutor. So her email makes no sense. She's clearly trying to find any sort of way to manipulate the situation to avoid admitting that she lied, to avoid updating her campaign material, to avoid having this used against her. But here's what it boils down to for me. Let's just kind of riff off each other here for a second, shall we? Like, let's say okay. You were trying to ascertain whether someone worked somewhere, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's say you were trying to ascertain whether you still had a job, okay?
Okay.
At the Undivided Podcast. Mm-hmm. What are a few things that would help you ascertain whether you're still employed?
Number one, a paycheck.
Okay, getting paid. That's a good, be a good indicator that you're still working somewhere. Yeah.
I'd probably go there.
Yeah.
Every morning.
You'd probably be working there, right? Like, you'd probably go to work. Uh-huh. You could also ask me, right? Or you'd reach out to the HR department. Yeah. That's me in this case. And say, hey, do I still work there? And if I told you no, what would you assume?
Probably that I didn't still work there.
That would be a good assumption. Yeah, I think those are the big things. Like, if you're asking yourself, do I still have a job there? Am I getting paid? Am I going to work? And if all else fails, I'll ask the HR department if I still am employed. And if they say, you're not, Manka, you don't work there anymore. I'm glad to help walk you through that scenario. So someone who's, thank you, Nicole.
Yeah,
that was a good exercise in just really running through things.
Right, right.
Someone who probably isn't fit to be the Attorney General. If you don't know whether you've worked somewhere for 3 years when you haven't gone in the building, I'm not sure that you can handle the job of Chief Law Enforcer for the state of Washington. Call me crazy. All right. So we told you that happening today, if you guys want to go, so Initiative 2066 appears headed to the November ballot, which is great. It'll give Washingtonians, business owners, homeowners alike an opportunity to maintain energy choice in our state, to keep using natural gas in your home and in your business if you choose to. So happening today, just to let you know before we dive into some other information on this, there is going to be two Let's Go Washington events actually happening this week. So there's going to be two turn-ins. They're going to today at 3 p.m., at the Secretary of State's office in Tumwater. They're going to be doing a turn-in of 425,800 signatures, which is well over what they need. And they're not done yet because they're going to be counting even more signatures that came in over the weekend. And they're going to do a final turn-in at the deadline this Friday, July 5th at 4 p.m. at the Secretary of State's office. That's at 243 Israel Road Southeast, building number 3 in Tumwater. I'll put this out on social media as well if you'd like to go and be there. It's kind of a cool thing to witness. It's democracy in action. Mm-hmm. Being able to witness the boxes and boxes and boxes of signatures of Washington voters who over the last month and a half have banded together to make sure they get energy choice on the ballot. So I want to talk a little bit about kind of where this goes from here and what's at stake. I mean, energy choice is one thing, but also what's at stake if Initiative 2066 does not pass in November. One of the key things that's going to happen is Democrats will then feel emboldened to go forth with what their plan is, and that's a full-fledged ban on natural gas. And that will have a huge ripple effect. It will hurt already struggling middle-class families in Washington state who are going to have to come out of pocket to electrify their home, who are going to pay higher energy rates. But it's also going to increase the cost of living. Because if you're a housing provider, right, if you're a landlord and you have to pay to electrify your home, what are you going to do with that cost? Well, you're going to pass it along to your tenant, to your current tenant or to a future tenant to try to help cover the cost. That is just what's going to happen. So that's what we're going to talk about today. The segment is brought to you in partnership with the Rental Housing Association of Washington. We talk to them every week about issues facing housing providers in the state of Washington. Sean Flynn, the executive director and board president of RHA, he has been a big proponent of energy choice. And so he joins us today to talk about this very issue, about what it could potentially do to housing prices during a housing affordability crisis if I-2066 does not pass in November. Sean, welcome back to Undivided.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again.
Yeah, so we've talked about Initiative 2066. RHA hasn't taken an official position on it yet, not that you're not going to, but it seems to be, you know, energy choice for, you know, homes and for businesses seems to be something that housing providers would be excited about.
Well, yeah, not just for the existing housing providers, but also for developers, right? We're short, I mean, depending on who you ask, up to 1 million housing units in the state of Washington.
Wow.
And we continue to fall behind every year in supply. And that is, a lot of that is caused by cost. And the stuff that we are building is unaffordable. And when you take away energy choice from the developers, that only drives cost of those units that are coming online. So we see less and less affordability.
Yeah. Does it surprise you? I mean, you knew, because we've talked about this with you before, the timeline for 2066 was very, very short relative to the other initiatives that were run last year. It seems like they could be on track to get 500,000 signatures by Friday. Does that exceed even what you expected?
Honestly, yeah. The rate at which the signatures were gathered on this initiative, we've had several initiatives in the not too distant past, and it took them longer on those. There seems to be a real, I would say, groundswell of support for this initiative. And I think that's around people wanting choice in their own homes. I think what a lot of folks see is that an initiative like this, it's only a matter of, without an initiative like this, it's only a matter of time before the government comes in and says, you're going to have to replace your furnace or your gas stove or your gas hot water tank. You know, not to date myself, and I know my hairline might do that for me, but I can remember a time when natural gas was the clean choice.
Yes.
And it wasn't that long ago that the government was spending lots and lots of money to, you know, for buses and other things that were going to run on natural gas. Clean burning natural gas was the thing. And now suddenly, because of an initiative pushed down from the higher echelons of government, namely Jay Inslee's office, not just through law, but also through the way the certain appointments worked out on the building code councils. Suddenly now we are moving, being forced to move to a electrification agenda over the next several years that in the experts that I've spoken with, not even sure if our electrical grid could handle it at the rate that they're setting. So I think this is too soon, too fast. And I think the consumers of Washington State need energy choice, and we need it for our housing supply.
Yeah, and energy choice, the choice part is really important here because nobody's saying like you can't electrify your home. If you want to do that, if people, builders want to build that way, that's fine. We're just saying give people a choice. For your housing providers, because I saw a graphic from the Building Industry Association of Washington, and I think it said like it would cost like $35,000 to $45,000 to electrify an average home. So how would housing providers in Washington, especially the ones who are members of RHA, because these are people who don't have, you know, thousands of units, they have a couple. How will they pay for that if that's the route the state goes?
So when people talk about electrifying a home in terms of your heating needs, normally in what they're really pushing you towards is a heat pump. And a heat pump's actually a great option. I made a choice to upgrade a home that recently that to move from a electric furnace to a heat pump, right, which is far more energy efficient and actually gets you air conditioning. But it was expensive. It was really expensive. But I also made the choice to have a gas backup furnace for those really cold days when a heat pump just doesn't work in our climates. And so that cost, if it was done on one of my rental properties, would be directly handed down in an increased rent for the person occupying the home. And that's not great, again, for housing affordability. And it's also a lot of cost in terms of upgrading other parts of your systems, right? Not every home has an electrical panel that's going to handle a heat pump, right? So electrification is not as easy as just swapping one furnace out for another. It's a far more complex situation in the way a house works, and those costs can spiral. I mean, I would not be shocked to hear $40,000-$50,000 from members on some of their older home upgrades that they're going to need to do. And what that does is that goes directly against our affordability mission that we're trying to do in the state, generally about housing costs.
Yeah, I mean, who's going to be able to come out of pocket $40,000-$50,000? They're just not. And I think that's why, and just to kind of bring it full circle and end here, that's one of my key frustrations here. We're already starting to see now that news has come out that there are likely enough signatures to send this to the ballot in November. There's this narrative coming out, well, we didn't ban natural gas. What are you talking about? You know, 1589 didn't ban natural gas. And I agree that, you know, it didn't actually say an explicit ban on natural gas, but it's pretty clear that's the way they're heading. So I guess, you know, given that that would be such a cost for a family, I would like to see, because we know that's the direction they're going, right? I guess I would like to see them message it early on, like, yeah, we are heading in that direction. 1589 might not have been the thing to do it, but people should start saving because we're going to, you know, require this at some point down the road. I mean, how long do you think it would take for them if this initiative does not pass to go down that path of banning natural gas?
Well, it really sort of depends on the next governor's administration and the way the legislature shakes out. But I think it's pretty clear from how we ended up with the bill last year at the legislature that this is a larger agenda and we're on the track to banning natural gas. And I think that the average citizen realizes that. I think that's why we've had such a rapid response in getting these signatures.
Yeah. Well, and I'll just point out, it started as a natural gas ban, 1589. It had it in there, banned new hookups. It got rid of the obligation to serve. And then there was pushback. So they watered it down. But let's not act like they didn't try to put a full-fledged ban in.
Oh, yeah. It started as a full-fledged ban. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, PSE was going to then raise your electrical rates to make up for the loss of revenue that they had from serving the gas customers. But that wasn't going to fly out of legislature. So we got this, which is sort of a half measure to this, but we're going to do this later. So anyone who tells you that that's not their eventual goal just isn't being intellectually honest. They want to ban natural gas and they want the state to be fully electrified. And I don't know how structurally we would do that or how we can afford to pay for it. Certainly not for folks who are already struggling with the housing costs as they are in the state.
Yeah, it's unreal. And again, I just go back to, like, if you're going to do it, be honest with people, because they're going to be the ones that have to pay for it. And if it's a good policy, you shouldn't have to be dishonest about it. But we only have to go back to the original.
And what I'd say is to the supporters of the policy, make your case.
Yes.
You know, make your case on why the average homeowner and renter is going to have to flip the bill for this thing. How much carbon are you going to reduce? Can the electrical grid handle it? Is this a good use of our funds? Are there better ways to help the environment than this policy? And my issue here is that no one made that case. Instead, this was pushed through, and you know, we'll see where the initiative goes. But if I were a betting man, which I totally am, my steak dinner bets are infamous. I would take a steak dinner bet all day long that this initiative passes when it goes to the ballot.
I'm not going to take you up on that bet because I agree with you. So I also enjoy a good steak dinner bet. Sean Flynn, we appreciate it. And you made a really good point there at the end. I just want to reinforce, like, make the case then. What happened to public servants making the case for policies they believe in? Instead, they push it through at 2 a.m. They lie to people about what it's going to do, about what their goals are. It's like, hey, if it's a good policy, make the case to the people you serve. So I think that's a good point. All right, Sean, we'll talk to you next week.
Hey, thanks so much. You guys have a great week.
So again, that's Sean Flynn with the Rental Housing Association of Washington. If you're a landlord in the state of Washington with all this insanity going on, make sure you sign up to become a member of RHA. It's $260 a year, and they can help you navigate this crazy situation we're in with laws that are decidedly anti-housing provider. RHAWA.org, RHAWA.org. But again, you know, something important brought up in that conversation is the fact that they tried to ban it in House Bill 1589. That's how it was introduced. No new connections, and allowed PSE to end its obligation to serve existing customers. They didn't think they could get it across the finish line, at least not this year, with that ban intact. So they watered it down. But the goal, that's clearly their goal. That's what the goal is. And so if Initiative 2066 doesn't pass in November, which I think it will, but if it doesn't pass in November, because what are they going to do until then? They're going to say, we're not trying to ban natural gas. We're not trying to do that. That's not what this did. You guys are crazy. Like, look, they're going to. They tried to. There wasn't the political will to get it across the finish line this year. But if voters don't stop it with 2066, they know that there's nothing stopping them. And they will move forward with their initial plans to ban it. So when they do something, when they say they want to do something, believe them. They're going to change their tune now, trying to prevent it. But they can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. All right. Okay, we're going to get to our segment Unbelievable next with another one of those rare stories about teachers going completely off script and showing kids things that are inappropriate. Never happens, right? Interesting. There's so many stories about it then. First, if you're in the market to sell your home, reach out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com. We hear from a lot of his satisfied customers like Bryce and Carla, who sold their home in Bellevue so they could retire in Florida. And they said it really showed that Wes has a lot of knowledge of the market, and he's been a real estate in this area for a long time through all the market ups and downs.
I'm just very detail oriented and never put down our property because you could hear I-90 from our property and it wasn't the most feng shui yummy piece of property, and our furniture never showed our house well, our own personal furniture. But he was like, oh yeah, he could see in his mind, this will show after the paint and the staging, this will be a premium property. He could see that. And he didn't let us feel like it was a subpar home the way it was.
Yeah, and Wes was able to help sell their home in 7 days over list price. That was in January, even with the market and the rates the way they are. So sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell or buy a home. If you're trying to buy a home as well, Wes and his team can help you out with that. All right, another example of a completely inappropriate video being shown to, in this case, elementary students that had a clear political and social undertones. Let's talk about it in our segment Unbelievable. Boop! All right. So there's a video at the center of this. The audio with it was just music. We had to cut it out because yesterday we got a copyright issue because of BET. And so we're just going to explain kind of what this video shows. But this is an exclusive story that came from our friend Jason Rance, host of the Jason Rance Show on 770 KTTH. There was a video shown to fifth graders in the Bellevue School District. I'm going to roll the video in a minute, but let me read a little bit of this Jason Rance reporting. Rants, school showed unsuitable video with controversial images to pre-K to fifth grade students. So this was like, not just fifth grade students, pre-K to fifth grade students. So here's how he describes it in his reporting. There were two assemblies at Bennett Elementary School on June 13th to discuss marine life as part of Earth Day presentations. They were led by a high school student group, the Environmental Impact Club. One of the assemblies was for K through second grade and another for third through fifth grade. According to a parent who spoke to the Jason Rance Show, a video titled, quote, "When humans switch places with animals" was shown to the students. However, according to a Bellevue School District spokesperson, the video was unsuitable for young learners. So Jason goes on to describe the animation. If you're watching the show, we'll roll the animation for you. It says the animation depicts a violent clash between animal protesters and police. So essentially the gist of the video is that they replace humans with animals and animals are humans. So they show an animal, you know, throwing a bottle into the water and then it winds up in an ocean and a little baby getting a plastic thing around its neck and like, oh, how horrible it would be. We'd care much more about the environment. But then it has this clash between what they're depicting as police. It says the animation depicts a violent clash between animal protesters and police. The police are depicted as snarling rats who indiscriminately attack the protesters with police sticks. There's even a scene of a polar bear stuck at work in a sea of cubicles. The Bellevue students see the polar bear rather than working, staring at his computer screen displaying two polar bears having sex in what is supposed to be a porn clip. The video does not show any body parts explicitly. The video ends with capitalist business rhinos enjoying cigars and drinking celebratory drinks because their company made a huge profit. Then the video transitions to a report of a climate crisis where all but 10,000 humans have perished into a scene at a museum featuring humans as extinct mammals. Wow. And it's a scary video, too. Like, I'm sorry, if you're a kindergartner, it's all dark and there's the creepy scene where what do you call the little round things that a pop goes into?
Oh, the plastic.
There's a word for that.
Soda holder.
Soda rings, whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, so the humans are animals, right? So the humans are swimming in the ocean in like a little pack, like fish, right? And then a net comes and it scoops up all of them except this baby. And the baby gets one of those rings around its neck and the baby grows into a teenager, and then the teenager gets suffocated and killed because the teenager also looks like the Little Mermaid.
Uh-huh.
So it's like this really graphic, bizarre, and they're trying to show like we'd never do this to humans, but we do it to animals, and they just throw in the police protest for no reason. So then you've got some of the animals who are like, we can't do this to the humans. So they're protesting. And then you've got police that are depicted as rats and they've got their sticks and they're just beating the hell out of the other animals.
On the polar bear that signs something that becomes whatever and sends people to an iceberg.
Yeah,
in the ocean.
Weird. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad the Bellevue School District came out and told Jason Rance it was unsuitable. Because it clearly is unsuitable. You can talk about loving and caring the environment without vilifying police, without having polar bears watching polar bear porn. Like, what is wrong with these people? They truly have a mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
It's genuinely unbelievable. By the way, I wanted to ask you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, just keeping this in mind, but also the stories that we've talked about related to education in the Olympia School District. Of course, we had the exclusive that we aired last week and talked again about this week about the Olympia School District teacher going on a political and social rant and it was only captured because a sixth grader recorded it. So it made us, one of our subscribers brought up, well, gosh, this makes me question some of the schools that are moving towards this system of locking up students' phones during class so it can't be distraction. So it's a complicated situation because it's like on one hand, you don't want the phone distracting kids, but on the other hand, Do you want kids to have that phone to capture crazy stuff their teachers might say and hold them accountable? So in our daily subscriber show poll on Patreon, Locals, and X, I asked, do you support locking up students' phones during class? I'm actually surprised how many of you still support it in light of those stories. It's pretty evenly split across our three subscription platforms. But more people right now are saying, yes, they do support kids having their phones locked up during class. Cheryl says, it's crazy that kids have phones in class. At the very least, they should be put away and turned off. And I do agree with that. But then it's like, gosh, would this sixth grader have caught her teacher talking about Trayvon Martin and Ronald Reagan and stuff? Nicole Hotto says, I like the idea of taking them to lessen the distraction. On the other side of that, if there's an emergency, I don't trust the schools to notify me in a timely manner. Then there's the possibility of teachers going off the rails because there's no chance of being recorded. The security thing is important too. Like, God forbid there's something that happens at school. Is your kid going to be able to get a hold of you? Don says, I worked in high schools for 19 years. Phones are a huge distraction. Yeah, and I think, God, I'm trying to think. I think just my last few years in high school is when phone use became pretty normal. Like, we still had the old school razor phones and stuff. But if you had it out in class, you got it taken away. And you couldn't come back to get it until the end of the day. So, yeah, I think that there's a line between maybe don't lock them up. But if the kid's using it, you got to take it from them to teach them a lesson. You know, like, no, you can come get it at the end of class and you got to live without your phone all day. Or they call their parents or something. I don't get why. I guess maybe I don't get why you have to lock it up. Can't the teacher just do something about it?
I would think so. I think that needs to be the policy. I know that was part of the investigation that we talked about yesterday. Mm-hmm. One of the things she was investigated for was allowing kids to use their phones,
yes,
in class.
That's so right.
I think it is a thing. They're not, yep, supposed to. It's just too often not enforced.
Yeah. And I think if you're a kid and you have your phone in class and you're not using it, I guess I don't see what the big deal is if it's tucked away safely in your backpack and you're told you can't use it in class, because then that allows them to have it if there's an emergency. It also allows them to have it if you have a sixth grade teacher who wants to rant about Ronald Reagan and HIV and homophobia. Christopher Hayes says, I support this. Phones should be locked up. I'll go a step further and say no smartphones until 14 and no social media until at least 16. I agree with that, too. Mm-hmm. I just don't want the government to be the one to institute it. I think parents need to be the one to set those guardrails for their kids. Okay, we're going to get to a little bit of national news coming up next, specifically a Jill Biden story. First, I've encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. You all need insurance, right? And so you want to make sure that you have the insurance to fit your needs, that you're properly covered, but also that you're not paying more than you have to. And if you're navigating the insurance industry on your own, that can be really difficult. That's why I encourage you to take the First Mark Challenge. First Mark Insurance is a wonderful broker that's been working locally in our area for a long time. And what they're going to do, the First Mark Challenge is completely free. They're going to talk to you about your current insurance policies, what your needs are. They're going to go out, they're going to shop their wide array of carriers and make sure they get you the right plan at the best price. And the best part is, you never pay First Mark a dime for their services, so it really is a no-brainer. Maggie sent us a message. She said that she'd resigned from her job after an unexpected situation at work, and that led her to finally take the First Mark Challenge. She had also just gotten her latest car insurance bill. It went up yet again, and she's like, I need to save some money. She said, I heard you advertise First Mark for months and months, but was skeptical. Would this actually save me money? I'm very happy to report I was connected with Levi at First Mark, and after he reviewed my car and home insurance, he recommended a new bundle that was half the cost and better coverage. I was very surprised and so thankful. So do what Maggie did, what so many others have done. Take the First Mark Challenge today. FirstMarkInsurance.com. FirstMarkInsurance.com. The very best part is they work for you and you never pay them anything. So really, I think there's two great things there. Okay, dipping outside of Washington State. So obviously there's a lot going on with the presidency. And it's interesting to watch this ebb and flow of where Democrats are at on any given hour of the day and deciding whether they want Joe Biden to step aside or not. I saw some reporting earlier that the Democratic Governors Association, so all the Democratic governors in the country, had a call without Joe Biden on it, basically saying, what should we do? What do we need to do? So that's happening. In the meantime, Jill Biden had a cover story for Vogue magazine. Now, this doesn't inherently bother me. I'm okay with politicians or politicians' wives being viewed as fashion symbols, gracing the cover of magazines. I'm fine. Although, I will just note, Melania Trump was very fashionable, and she never got the cover of fashion magazine. So there's a little bit of a bias there. But so the timing of this and what's happening in the country and in the world leads me to think that this particular cover shoot is in incredibly poor taste. So Jill Biden's on the cover of Vogue. I'll show you just a picture of the cover. It says the First Lady Jill Biden, and a quote from her saying, "We will decide our future." And it has her standing there in this white tuxedo dress, looking off into the distance, looking very regal and fashionable. Now, it's interesting because this edition came out, so it's the August edition, but they released them a little bit early. They had done most of the interviewing and reporting prior to the debate. And so it's interesting, the timing of the release with now all this renewed controversy over whether she's guilty of elder abuse and whether she is forcing her husband to run for another term when he's clearly not fit for office. So a lot of this article kind of waxes poetic about her. It does include an editorial note at the top of it just saying that the debate on June 27th spurred a discussion about whether President Joe Biden should remain the Democratic nominee, and then it includes a quote from her on that. However, that's not what seems tone deaf for me. I mean, that is, you know, all this stuff going on and having her on the cover of Vogue. I gotta be honest, it's the dress she's wearing. It's the whole, here we have this time where obviously any leader knows that people are struggling financially, where there is a lot going on domestically. There's a lot happening on the world stage. When you look at what's happening with Israel and Gaza, Ukraine and Russia, there's a lot of suffering happening in the world. There's a lot of suffering happening domestically, specifically when it comes to the economy and people's ability to provide for their families. And so any, I think, reasonable person who understands optics would tell Jill, maybe a Vogue cover shoot where you are wearing, we looked up the dress she's wearing. It's from Ralph Lauren. It's a Christian silk tuxedo dress. It costs $4,990. $4,990. My wedding dress cost less than half that. And I don't think that she bought this dress. I don't think that's her dress. I think that it's a fashion magazine, so they put her in something fashionable, and I think it looks very fashionable. But it's the optics, and it's sending a message to people who are struggling, like, oh, here's the First Lady looking glamorous in a $5,000 gown. And clearly disconnected from the reality of Americans. And even if you don't care, right? Even if you don't care as Jill Biden what Americans are going through and you're like, I want to be on the cover of Vogue, you should at least care about the optics in a presidential election year where the economy is front and center, don't you think? Don't you think someone in her circle would say, can we put her in maybe jeans and something to make her look a little more like relatable as opposed to a $5,000 Ralph Lauren dress? It's baffling to me. And you should really read the article because the entire first, like, you know, these types of magazine articles, they're always very like, oh, winding and storytelling and all of that. And the whole first paragraph is about, I'll just read a part of it. If you want to know what power feels like, try to get yourself driven around in a motorcade. Flashing police chaperone lights form a perimeter as you blaze down an empty highway, waiting cars backed up on entry ramps as you pass. It's as if the world is holding its breath for you. Also, rules don't apply. Like, yeah, that doesn't make her look particularly good. I mean, it's not a hit piece on Jill Biden whatsoever, but it's just, this is my first glimpse of First Lady Dr. Jill Biden exiting the sealed chamber of power into the middle of America, a vision of calm. Like, how disconnected from reality is that? It's wild. So I don't know who our handlers are, but man, if I were running a presidential campaign for someone, I would say at least attempt to look like you know what everyday Americans are dealing with. Ridiculous. Okay, let's get to a couple questions and comments, and then we'll revisit the rest of everything else. Some nice super chats. You guys are so sweet. You're giving me super chats for my birthday. You don't have to do that, but that's so nice. I don't even know if I can get to all of them. Bill Biz, happy birthday, Brandy. Old Sub Sailor. Oh, I get it. $36 super chats. I like this idea for birthday present. Happy birthday, Brandy. Matt Gilbert, happy birthday, Brandy. Excited to see what great things you're going to do this next year. Matthew Cook, happy birthday, cocktail. Cheers. Jay says, happy birthday. Tracy, happy birthday. Summer CS, happy birthday, Brandy. As a Chinese American, I'm curious how the Dems in Olympia determined that Koreans and Indians were more discriminated, were the more discriminated against Asians. Interesting. I don't know. Crafty Grandma Crispy, happy birthday. In other news, I have a friend that works at a sewage treatment plant, and natural gas is a byproduct of that process. They are currently selling it to PSE. If they can't sell it, they will have to burn it. That's interesting. That's worth looking into more. Kathy Carr, happy birthday, Brandy. Thank you. You guys are so nice. Beth Dutton, I already subscribed to you, but my husband is subscribing today in honor of your birthday. Thanks, guys. See, that's the best birthday gift. Lynn Blevins on Jay Inslee's dictatorship light. Absolute power corrupts absolutely should be the slogan for the state of Washington. And a lot of other places as well. Captain Cranky Pants, PSE just sent out notices telling us to cut back on electric use during peak times because the grid can't handle all the demand. Exactly. How do you think it's going to operate when you take away an alternative? Are we all of a sudden going to out of nowhere have much more capacity for electricity? I tend to think not. So I don't understand. I mean, I understand why Jay Inslee is trying to cement a legacy, you know, for being the climate governor. But don't you think that they would be very concerned about all of a sudden forcing people to use the electrical grid when it's already failing? And for the love of God, don't turn access to your thermometer over to the government for some power savings. Do not do that. I don't think I have to tell you guys that, but do not do that. Wendy Rush, once again, Brandy is at the tip of the spear, launching truth to Washingtonians. Thank you. I did not know so much behind the natural gas bill's original egregious intents. Great show. Thank you, Wendy. Appreciate that. Dawn, for current homeowners, they'll expect us to finance off our home equity and will reduce sales received on sales tax, basically robbing us. So you're saying basically they would require you to pay to electrify your home based off your home equity. And then I'm not sure I understand the second part of that comment, but feel free to clarify. Rick E., 25 years ago, I was in a constitutional law class at Old Dominion University, part of a group research paper where we wrote on housing discrimination. The professor, who was also a federal attorney, was shocked when we reported that the largest group regularly discriminated against in U.S. history was Jewish people. Yeah, I mean, I knew there was a little bit of that, but I certainly didn't know it was on par with what Black Americans had suffered in terms of housing discrimination. And again, if you're going to write one wrong, why would you not write other wrongs? That makes no sense to me, not at all. All right, before we get to our closing sanity check, Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital, they're going to be having another one of their Know Your Risk webinars coming up at the end of this month, July 25th at 3:30 p.m. They started to do a bunch of these because they've been so popular. They're specifically targeting these seminars for people who are concerned about inflation. So if you're getting close to retirement, you've planned, you've saved, you've done all these things, and now you're in this inflationary environment where you might not be able to afford the type of retirement that you thought you were saving for. So Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark, they're going to talk you through all that, help you understand sort of what you can do to protect your retirement in this inflationary environment. And then you've also got, of course, the Lumen election, global unrest, market volatility. All of that impacts your retirement. And this is what Bulwark Capital specializes in, is managing your risk, always seeking to lower risk, lower costs, give you as much upside as possible. So don't miss Zach's special inflation webinar, July 25th at 3:30 p.m. Pacific time. Sign up now at knowyourriskradio.com. That's knowyourriskradio.com. It's completely free. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial, LLC, and SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. And with that, let's get to our closing sanity check. All right, after his disastrous debate performance, President Biden and his team are, of course, eager to prove to Americans that he is up to the task. So they trotted him out for 4 minutes to talk about the Supreme Court decision regarding presidential immunity, and he pulled a Ron Burgundy.
Justice Sotomayor's dissent today. Here's what she said. She said, in every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. With fear for our democracy, I dissent. End of quote.
End of quote. Good thing I don't use a teleprompter, or I'd probably pull some Ron Burgundy moments, too. That has been it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your... Done 1 minute early. Happy birthday to me. Thank you so much for your support of the show. Truly, it does mean the world to us. We do appreciate you guys every single day that you allow us to do the jobs that we love full time. It is absolutely a blessing, and I'm particularly grateful for it today on my birthday. So we will see you back here on the live show tomorrow. So we'll have a regular live show tomorrow. We will not have a show on our nation's birthday, the 4th of July, but we will have a regular episode of Sundays with Subscribers this week. So you can sign up for $5 a month, undividedpod.com. See you right back here at noon.